in the Yigdal is, but Yigdal lo yichai v'yishtabach, this is just a prelude, exalted be the living God and praise. First principle, minso, he exists, then eitam so unbounded by time is his existence. So the first principle of the Yigdal is the existence of God. Look at the animamim. The first principle of animamim, I believe with complete faith that the Creator, blessed is His name, creates and guides all creatures, and that He alone made, makes, and will make everything. It doesn't say anything in this first principle of the Rambam, Animamin, about God's existence. He says, what God does. You see the difference between the Yigdal and Animamin? Those who just came in, should take a sitter. I don't know if that has any mom in it. You should say, just take a regular article.
It has it.
So the Yigdal actually has the existence of God as the first principle. The Animamin doesn't have the existence of God, but rather what God does. He creates stuff, and He leads stuff. See that? Question, who's right? What's the first principle of the Rambam? So it seems that actually the first principle of the Rambam is that God exists. Yigdal is right and the Animamin is wrong. In other words, the Rambam says at the beginning of Mishnah Torah, the Yisoida Yisoida, the foundation of all foundations is that there is one true existence, and that true existence is God. By true existence we mean something which must exist. Everything else which exists doesn't necessarily have to exist. Everything can go poof and disappear. But God cannot go poof and disappear. So therefore, since that is the case, the Rambam says, one must believe that there is a God. Here the Animam is frozen in all sorts of extraneous material. Again, that God creates and He conducts, He does and He did, all sorts of wonderful things, but that's not really part of basic building block, the basic principle number one. Now, if you desire, if you really want to, we can go through all the kinds of evidence which there are for God's existence. But I'm not so sure it's necessary, so let's just go give a brief run through, and if you want more explanation, we can go through it at a different time, or today, or later. But there are several different approaches in Judaism towards proving God's existence or bringing evidence for God's existence. One of them is, of course, the philosophical approach, which is usually not used nowadays, which is the approach that everything has a first cause. If you go back to the ultimate first cause, that ultimate first cause is God, right? Since everything in this world has a precursor, something which brought it about, so therefore the ultimate precursor is the Creator, that's God. That's in a nutshell a very complex argument that actually would take a long time to discuss it in any detail. The two major forms of evidence which Judaism uses, though, are not the philosophical one, but rather, A, the wonders of the creation, how the creation is so wondrous and so complex and so beautiful and so impressive that there must have been a creator, and the way it's expressed by the rabbis is just like a garment testifies that there's a tailor and a house testifies that there was a builder, so to the creation testifies that there was a creator. The third category of evidence, which is normally used, again, is the tradition from Mount Sinai. The revelation of Mount Sinai was witnessed by the Jewish people, and therefore, it was passed down from generation to generation, and our tradition going back in an uninterrupted chain to Mount Sinai indicates to us that there is a God, that God communicated with the Jewish people at the time that he came down, so to speak, give us the Torah at Mount Sinai. There are all sorts of other categories of evidence, which have to do for example, I believe it was Toynbee, some secular historian, I think it was Toynbee, who said that the evidence that there is a God is the fact that the Jewish people have existed throughout the generations.
Yeah, that's the best one.
What?
I think that's the best one.
Yeah, Toynbee was not a typical lover of the Jews, as far as I understand correctly, but he said, nevertheless, the fact that the Jews exist in the case that there must be some creator, because it's beyond belief that the Jews have survived through everything, through thick and thin. And so, of course, one can bring evidence from the greatness of the sages, the Talmudic sages, and the righteousness of our great righteous people, who it seems to indicate that Judaism produces the most holy, not everybody, of course, not even the majority, but the very special and unique individuals who Judaism produces who are holy and transcendent. But the bigger evidence also from the way the Torah has very profound aspects to it, particularly secrets of the Kabbalah, things like that. This was honor, right? So the and one can so there's many different categories of evidence which can be brought to bear. But the basic three are philosophical, tradition, and the complexities, the wonders of creation. Rabbi Chana Wasserman, in a very famous piece, Rabbi Chana Wasserman was a Rosh Hashiva, was when he was killed in the Second World War. Actually went back, he was in America at the beginning of the war, he went back to Europe to be killed. I don't think he knew he was going to be killed, but they tried to get him to stay here, but he refused. He didn't want to go back to the students. He writes, he has a question. This is the best question. He says, you know, the halacha is that every non-Jew has to accept the seven Noahide commands. I can't stand the word Noahide, but I don't know the better word.
I think it's Noahide, right?
What?
Is it Noahide?
Noahide, whatever it is. So they have to accept the seven, they're actually more than seven. But you know, whatever laws there are, which are basic for non-Jews. So he says, and about halacha is, if you come to a non-Jew and he refuses to accept these seven laws, so we kill him. Right? That's about halacha. We kill him. So according to Rambam, of course, that makes sense, right? Rambam says, because we said before, Rambam holds, if you don't accept the logic of the Torah, that means there's something deficient about your mental processes. And of course the Rambam means, the Rambam would hold people who are deficient in their mental processes have lost their right to live. Right? This is classic Maimonidean elitism. So the,
wait, you said they have more than seven?
Yeah.
Like what?
The prohibition on castration, for example, is an eighth one.
Isn't that included in one of the other ones? No?
No.
How many are there total?
I think certain non-Jews haven't been to the Bris Mila, so they're eight or nine, depending on how you count.
What non-Jews?
Nei Ketura.
Nei what?
The children of Avram's Avram's concubine.
Arabs?
What?
Arabs?
Well, not not Ishmaelis. The Rambam says the descendants of Ishmael of Ishmael are not required to be circumcised, but since the descendants of Keturah's children, you know, Keturah was, according to Rashi, was Hagar, which the second time around she was called Keturah, since their descendants have become commingled with the Arab population, so therefore the Arabs have to become circumcised.
So a Muslim who circumcises his son is actually doing a mitzvah?
Yeah, one of their commandments. So it's actually, you know, I don't know if I remember all of them offhand, but there's belief in God, denial of idolatry, adultery, theft, murder,
set of court. Limb off of an animal.
What?
Limb off of an animal.
Right, not take a limb off an animal. Right. So those are the seven basics.
And then you said castration.
Castration. So non-Jews are not allowed to castrate any animal. That's eight. And Bris Mila is nine.
So you're saying that Bob Barker's going to hell?
What about Bob Barker?
At the end of every show
host.
Yeah, at the end of every single show, he says, and remember, have your pet spayed or neutered.
Oh, yeah, but not him. So
but he's talking so much castration.
Castration of animals as well as people? Oh,
yeah.
And if he doesn't agree, we kill him.
What?
Yeah, go after Bob Barker.
actually, for that one, I'm not sure you have to kill him for that. But
maybe we just castrate him.
Forbid it.
Oh.
Better killing than castrating. I don't believe we kill for that eight prohibition. We only kill for the basic seven. But
so you're saying that technically, halakhically, if I go to Berkeley and find a group of the student anarchist group, and I say, these are the seven laws that you must abide by, including the court system, and they're total anarchists, so they reject every single one of my seven, I have a chiyuv to kill them?
According to the Rambam? Yeah. Well, you don't have a personal chiyuv to kill them, you schlep them to court, and, you know,
you need a basis.
Yeah. Only on the sidewalk, because it's dark. Not in the parking lot.
So I could take him to the Sanhedrin and have him killed.
Or they could authorize, you know, they can give you a license to kill, like James Bond. They can give to do that for you. But
how do you know about James Bond?
I have never seen it, just by reading and the reaction to the James Bond movie. The in any event, Rabbi Chana, he is not there. You know, you come to one of the pygmies, the deepest, darkest Africa, and you say, "We're pygmies. Either accept God or we kill you," right? What do you got to say? It's not my fault, right? Here I am living the life of picking an apple. How is I supposed to know about God? Right? Can't. It's not fair to hold me accountable for that. Not only that, by the way, it's interesting halacha. The Rambam says, the Rambam rules, that not only does a non-Jew have to accept the seven mitzvahs, but he has to accept them because Moshe Rabbeinu commanded them at Mount Sinai to the non-Jews. Meaning that it's not enough that he recognizes that these commands are legitimate and rational commands, but he's got to accept that Moshe Rabbeinu was the one who conveyed them to the non-Jews from Mount Sinai. It's an amazing concept.
Congress agrees to that.
What?
Congress passed a law. And
says what?
The Lubavitchers got it through Congress somehow, and the first George Bush. You can look it up. It's online. They actually have a bill that they passed that sets up Education Day in America, whatever, but it's in the whereas or whatever. One of them says, "Whereas we recognize as the United States Congress that the foundation of society rests upon certain key principles known throughout history as the seven Noahide laws, and that without these principles, society would crumble and fall." But they don't mention Moshe, so I guess it doesn't count.
They don't mention Moshe.
And there's no penalty section.
So Rabbi Chanan says, the way he explains it, he says, you know, there's a pasuk in Torah which we say every day, twice a day. It says, "Lo tasur achrei levavchem v'achrei einechem." Do not stray, do not deviate from the right path by following your heart and your eyes. So the Gemara says, the Medr says, "Achrei levavchem," do not follow your heart, that is heresy. So the pasuk tells you not to be a heretic. So Rav Chanan says, right, understand. It shouldn't say, don't follow your heart in not being a heretic. It should say, don't follow your faulty mind, your brain. Because where do people become heretics? Not in their heart. They become heretics in their brain. You want to be an apikoros, you have to think like an apikoros, right? So Rav Chanan says, no. He says, any person, and again, this is very Maimonidean, any person who thinks straight, and clear and lucid, sees that there must be a God. The world is too complex for there not to be a God. The world is too wonderful for there not to be a God. The only reason a person would deny that there exists a God is because he has his own agenda he wants to follow. In other words, if there's a God, logic dictates, again, taking things logic, that God has a certain plan, and that there's certain things which you should do and certain things which you shouldn't do. And then you don't have absolute, so to speak, license. So therefore, people would prefer, because of their heart's desires, to reject belief, in order to be able to do what they want, not because they think that this is in fact the case. So Rabbi Chanan says, belief is logical, rejection of belief comes, at least in God, for now, rejection of belief comes from a person's emotional side. Yeah.
What about a lot of the fried Jews in college or whatever, a lot of them say, "Well, I believe in God, but I believe that he set up the universe and let it run on autopilot and doesn't care."
Right.
So if someone, not religious, so if someone, if someone,
Yiddish,
means free,
right.
Free of obligations. So if someone says that, or if a goy says that, if a goy says, "I do believe in God. I believe that there was a God that made the universe, but then he set it on autopilot and he doesn't care anymore. He did it for a laugh or whatever."
Right.
Is that considered against this injunction or not?
Well, there's several ways of dealing with that. But Rabbi Chanan says is that it follows logically that if there is a God, that he is purposeful, because the creation is too wonderful for him just to have wasted his time and walked away. So if it's purposeful, logic dictates that there is a plan or some sort of, instruction manual by which one should live life in this world. And then he says, so logic dictates that the instruction manual was given. Where was it given? So then we know. This non-Jew, this pygmy, Mr. Pygmy, Red Pygmy in Africa, were he really to have, you know, done what he's supposed to do his homework, he would have gone to, he would have gone through, as many possible religions as he could have found, and he would have ultimately come to the conclusion that, well, Judaism is probably where it's at. Now, I want to make this clear. We don't expect the pygmy necessarily to come on his own to this belief, although he should, according to Rabbi Yonah. But we can't kill him until we try to educate him, and he refuses to be educated. Is that clear? We first have to try to get him to see the light. If he doesn't see the light, then certain things follow. Okay? So now, and of course, this goes without saying, but it's nevertheless worthwhile mentioning, nobody has to convert to Judaism. Only Jews are stuck with Judaism. If you're a non-Jew, then you can remain a non-Jew, and you can get to the world to come, just even easier than a Jew can. Nobody has to convert from the Jewish perspective to Judaism as long as they keep those seven laws. Right?
Eight or nine.
How
do we kill them? Skila or?
No, sword.
Sword.
Okay. Whenever you kill a non-Jew, you run through the sword. I think you get to use a gun.
Oh. Dan's loving this.
Now
this is what we don't teach during Kiruv sessions, then.
Oh, you don't do this
during
Kiruv sessions? As I said, the very basic principle is the existence of God, based on evidence, which we have. The second principle, the additional material, which is in the Animamin, is very confusing. The reason why it's confusing is because it throws in this line that God is foray, create, that we know, but that's a separate principle which comes up later on in the 13 principles. And then it says, manhig, he leads kol habruim, he leads all creatures. Now, what does that mean, he leads all creatures? Does he lead them like a horse to water? Does he lead them to the promised land? What does it mean, he leads all creatures? This language of the Animamin, it's a very ambiguous language. I had in one of my other jobs, I do writing for a new project called the Tayag Legacy Foundation. The Tayag Legacy Foundation is working on a major encyclopedic work and also fancy educational materials on the 613 mitzvahs, and they're just starting. So they're starting with the ten commandments, and they're actually not ten, I think about 14. That's the introduction, we're pointing out, never realized before. In Aseret HaDibros, actually, there are 10 utterances, there are 10 Dibros, but there are more than 10 commands in them, there are about 14 or 15, I don't remember how many. But in any event, so the first things I got to translate was a work on Emunah, which came from Israel. And this work on Emunah, which came from Israel, said that, first of all, the fellow who wrote it said, he wrote, in our day and age, we don't involve ourselves in any types of proof or evidence concerning the existence of God. Rather, we just accept it as a given because our fathers told us so. So I went ballistic when I saw that. I called them up and I complained. I said, what about basic forms of evidence? The tradition from Mount Sinai, the complexity of creation. So there are a lot of sources who frowned on philosophical inquiry because philosophical inquiry is A, difficult, B, it changes, philosophy changes from generation to generation. But basic evidence, what's wrong with that? So he said to me, listen, this work is meant for the Chadorim, for want of a better term, the ultra-Orthodox schools in Israel. And the ultra-Orthodox schools, we don't anymore learn things like Jewish thought, machshava, or the different perspectives, hashkafa. We just learn a little bit of Musar. So therefore, we don't put this kind of stuff into the curriculum. So I went into a deep depression for 2 days. But before that, I said to him, nope, Baruch Hashem, and chutzpah was the outside line of Israel, was still allowed to think. And then I rewrote the entire mitzvah to my, for the American audience. To my satisfaction.
Right on.
I enjoyed that. One of the other things he wrote there, which is incorrect, is that part of this mitzvah is to believe, part of this animam, this principle of belief, which is the first mitzvah, is the mitzvah of Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the God of your Lord. Part of it is to believe that God is constantly paying attention, controlling, and manipulating, for want of a better word, the destiny of every single aspect of every single thing which exists in creation.
That part of one, or is that a separate?
That's part of one. Because it says that in the Animani, God is manhig, with chol ruin. Right?
So is that one of the 13 principles you're articulating, is Hashem exists and he's in control?
Right.
That's two separate principles.
So I said that this is not true. It's not part of the principle.
And I was about to write it down.
But he said it is part of the principle. And he cited a Rambam, which seems to hold that part of the belief that there's a God is that the God is also the controller of the world. Right?
Well, it follows logically.
It follows logically, but it says part of the principle. But, and this is true, it does follow logically that part of being God is that you're in control. But what he contended then is that part of being God and being in control is micromanagement. We call that in Hebrew what? Who knows? What? Very good. You're hot today. Hashgacha Pratis, specific, individualistic, divine attention and control. Does anybody here ever hear of Hashgacha Pratis before? In modern day Jewish thought, Hashgacha Pratis is taken to be a given. It's taken to be a given. Everything is controlled by God. Hashgacha Pratis is a term which was invented within the last 500 years. It didn't exist previously. Because previously, although there were Rishonim who held that there is such a concept as Hashgacha Pratis, many Rishonim, among them the Rambam, held there is no such thing, except for the greatly righteous and pious individuals.
And kings, right?
What?
And kings?
No, kings only as relates to the nation, not as relates to their individual
right,
selves.
Right, but I mean...
Yeah. But that's really part of Hashgacha Pratis, the general conduct of the world. So according to there is a statement from the Rebbe Rebunin, Rebbe Rebunin Parshitko, which he says, if you take a stick out of the sand, some of you must have heard this when you say this, you take a stick out of the sand, what happens to the sand?
It goes in the hole.
Goes into the hole, right? Each particle of sand goes into a specific place in the hole. The Rebbe Rebunin said, if you don't believe that God ordained at that moment where every particle of sand should fall into the hole, you are not Bikoyret.
I agree.
You're a heretic. Okay? So that's Rebbe Rebunin.
I disagree with you.
On the other hand, the Rambam held, welcome to disagree, there is no resolution to this argument. Everybody, people have disagreed for years on this.
I agree.
The Rambam held that God doesn't even care about individual animals. Not even about most individual human beings. He cares about the species, whether species are extinct or not. The Rambam does. The Rambam holds God is involved in that decision. A few years ago in the northwest part of the United States, there was a whole issue about the spotted owl, whether it would go extinct because, I think, of logging operations. They were cutting down too many trees. I think that's what it was. So according to the Rambam, could be Hashem was concerned with the spotted owl. I don't know. Could be he wasn't, because there are many other owls besides the spotted owl. But maybe spotted owl is sufficiently a species that Hashem should be concerned with it. But in any event, how many individual spotted owls there are and where they live is not a concern to Hashem.
What does that mean, not of concern to Hashem?
Hashem doesn't control that. Hashem lets nature control that autopilot.
But Hashem controls nature.
Hashem has authority, but he doesn't necessarily have.
Right. Hashem put nature, according to the Rambam, and according to most Rishonim, as opposed to most Achronim, nature is a real thing. Nature means, in other words, there are rules of nature.
Right.
And the way God decided to conduct the world early on is by rules of nature. Why? Mm-hmm. It makes sense. They're divine. So therefore Hashem let nature run its course.
But if you say that, then you could also just take that back farther and just say that Hashem created the universe at the start and then put in the laws of nature and just psh, let it fly.
No. So that's the thing. Rambam's later principles indicate that Hashem does intervene. That's the point. Hashem does intervene because he does have a master plan, but as little as possible.
Right.
The Rambam's law of miracles is Hashem makes miracles, but he makes as few miracles in as subtle and non-apparent ways as possible.
So on
a small
scale.
By the way, it's not just the Rambam's rule. It's a general rule in Judaism.
On a small scale.
What?
For instance, like in your sand in the hole, right?
Yeah.
The determination of where each sand grain is going to go into that hole is you're getting down to the level of stuff that's not predictable because it's too
right. So Hashem lets gravity.
Too non-dynamic.
So Hashem lets gravity control that.
No, but at the non-dynamic level, things are not exactly controllable by laws of nature. They're probabilities. So then that's where Hashem is can have subtle effect.
But why should
it?
Why does it?
He has to.
Why?
Because a particle has to be somewhere.
So what?
So where does it decide to go? There are no laws of nature that determine that.
Gravity?
No, I'm talking about a small scale, very small scale.
Oh, you mean subatomic scale?
Not even subatomic, atomic scale. Where things are is not determined by a precise, exact position on exact natural law. It's a probability, and so where it really is determination of our shape.
Okay,
and therefore, that makes where each sand grain defaults.
Stick to a Newtonian universe.
Yeah. He wants to name this.
Then you're denying reality.
Heisenberg principle?
Yeah.
Things take on a location only when somebody observes them, since Hashem observes everything, so therefore he must control everything. Is that correct?
Somewhat, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I'm Newtonian. I agree with that.
Right, but then it's denying reality.
Okay, you could say that again. And anyway,
that's why I agree with him, by the way. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't.
That's fine. So but according to the Rambam, let's just understand the Rambam as the Rambam. The Rambam says that God's major concern is nations, species, nations, and not all nations, almost all nations. Which nation doesn't he care about?
The 70 other ones?
Amalek.
Right. Amalek is what's the word? So bad. And Hashem says, you know what? Just kill them all. What?
We don't know how Amalek is.
Well, it's not relevant, right? But theoretically, the hypothetical of that is that Hashem cares about nations, but this nation not. By the way, the Rambam also holds, though, about Amalek, that if you want to destroy Amalek, first you have to offer them the opportunity to accept the 7 Noahide laws, and then you allow them to survive. So there is no specific mitzvah point for the Rambam to kill Amalek out of hand, only if they don't accept.
That's with all goyim too.
What?
Isn't that with all goyim also?
Yes. The question
so there's no distinction.
What?
Then it makes no sense because there's no distinction.
No. According to the Rambam, it's a mitzvah to wage war against Amalek. It's not a mitzvah to wage war against the other nine nations.
Okay.
The wage in the war, you should wait, but you should give them the options before you kill them.
Talk to a goy and we get into a conversation about religion, and we find out that he's a disbeliever, and we try to educate him, then we're hired to kill him, right? But we're not hired to start that conversation, except unless he's from Amalek. Okay.
But it's also with Amalek, it's not, according to Rambam, it's not with the individual. There's no mitzvah to kill an individual Amalekite.
So how could you kill any of them?
You go to war. Once you got to war, and you win the war, then you kill them.
But that's individuals.
Yeah, but it's the same. It has to start with a war. It doesn't start with individuals going out on vigilante justice and going and killing Amalek and left and right. It'd be an army which wages war.
Okay, just want to make sure. Point of all is how Hashem exists and has authority. There are two views. The Rambam view is that Hashem is concerned about the big issues, nations, species, otherwise, etc. Otherwise, creates rules.
And the great personages.
Nation, species, great persons, otherwise creates the rules of nature and allows them to operate, versus the view that Hashem controls the outcome of every single detail of existence, which is whose point of view?
The Hasidic. Hasidic and Kabbalistic point of view.
But according to that point of view...
According to the Hasidic Kabbalistic point of view, Rabbi Dessler writes, for example, there really is no such thing as nature. We call nature what we're accustomed to see take place, because since a moment ago, right, if I'm right now, right, if I drop this, and it falls, right? If I drop it again, it'll fall again. So I say, oh, the nature of objects is that they fall to the ground, or fall down, gravity. But the Calvinists would say, there is no nature. Nature is just what you're accustomed to seeing happen. But in fact, there is no reason to assume that the next moment pens, instead of falling down, will start falling up.
So every second is a different scene in a great divine plan. The scenery could be set differently, and the motions could be set differently. It's just because Hashem chooses to make the pen fall there. He could easily choose to make it go up in the next scene.
Exactly.
And he might very well do it.
Right.
It's also what quantum mechanics says.
What?
Quantum mechanics also says when you drop your pen, it calculates every projectile, including going around the nearest galaxy and back, and does the one that's most probable, which is down to the ground. So it actually does, it does have an option of going anywhere.
Yeah, the first person I meet was after the Hasidic viewpoint because of scientific principle. I've never seen that before. This is truly remarkable. Okay, I think this is the first.
But according to the view that Hashem controls, the Hasidic view that everything is determined, so according to that view, how do they explain the recurring laws of nature, like the laws of what we call laws of nature? Is that just one static thought? Hashem thinks this is the way the world wants to work, and then that's a constant awareness, and therefore everything was pre-planned so that with this constant awareness of these laws, in effect, things will happen exactly the way Hashem wants?
Well, since Hashem transcends time, so it's really not a valid question. Time is linear, but Hashem's time is not linear.
Right. But he created a linear time universe.
Right. So in the linear time, it seems that, you know, there is such a thing as nature.
So he made these laws such that the linear time would go through exactly the way he wanted.
Right.
But the laws still are there. It's just that they're there to do the will. So they are the will of Hashem.
Mm-hmm.
They are his thought, so to speak. Yeah, I agree with that.
Now, an important point to make about this is, another important point, is that if you think about it for a few moments, then you'll see that the concept of free will, of free choice, has to be radically different according to the Rambam and according to the Hasidim. Because according to the Rambam, that things are reasonably unfettered, free of control. So free will is pretty, pretty broad and pretty, pretty, you know,
easy to explain.
Easy to explain. According to the Hasidim, that everything is micromanaged by God, we have a very grave difficulty understanding where free will comes into play. Where exactly does your free will take place? If God is micromanaging every moment, where is the free will? What choices do you actually have to make in life? In other words, if right now God has decreed that my pen should fall and it should break, I hope not. So then, what choice? It's not my choice to drop the pen, right? It's God decided that it should break at this point in time. Well, so what did I choose to do? I didn't choose anything. So according to the Hasidim, this is a very difficult concept to understand, the concept of free choice. There are some Hasidim, including some of my favorite Hasidim, the Reb Tzadok and his Rebbe the Ishbitzer, who hold there really is no such thing as free will. There's no such thing as free choice. Your life is pre-programmed. The question is what attitude you take towards your life. In other words, the soul is free, but the body is not necessarily free. Everything which happens to life may well be part of God's pre-planning. If it's part of God's pre-planning, you don't really have a choice, but you have a choice as to how you respond to the things that are going on with your body. You see how that works?
But a lot of times your
action is on attitude, not necessarily on act.
But your next actions often depend upon your attitude of the previous action. If something happens and I feel, I choose to feel happy about it, I might do something different than if I chose to feel bad about it.
But it may well be, so then it becomes a question of how much God lets your attitude determine what happens, and how much God determines what happens. In other words, you know, at some point, Hashgacha Pratis creates a tremendous paradox. The paradox is that Hashgacha Pratis tells us that everything that happens to a person is for a person's benefit, right? It's one of the corollaries of Hashgacha Pratis. Everything which is done for the benefit of a person, benefit of the world. It's for the good of a person. That means that God has to dictate what's good for you at this point in time. If God dictates what's good for you at this point in time, so what choice are you making? It should be that whatever happens to you now, being the best possible scenario for you in the world at this time, was planned by God. So therefore, the free will concept, the free choice concept, breaks down at some point. There's stories that there was a book, there was an advertisement. I don't know if the book was ever written. I hope it wasn't. There was an advertisement which was in the Jewish newspapers for several months after the World Trade Center was knocked down, advertising that if people had stories about Hashgacha Pratit, how their lives were saved miraculously, they should please send them to such and such address because we want to put out a book on the topic. But now, the whole concept is a fallacy because not only they are subject to Hashgacha Pratit, but you must believe that then all the people who were killed in the World Trade Center, it was the best possible scenario for them to be killed at that point in time in that place. Right? Because Hashgacha Pratit doesn't just mean Hashgacha Pratit for being saved, it means Hashgacha Pratit for being killed as well. There's a Voltaire, who was a French philosopher in the 1800s, he wrote a satirical novel. It was named, Zadik. The satire was how he made fun of the concept that people, I guess it's popular in certain circles of time, that everything which happens is for the best in the best of all possible worlds. Right? And there's a term in English, the philosopher who said that in the book, there's a term. There's a philosopher in the book. In the book, there's a philosopher who spouts this philosophy, and I've seen this actually in newspapers. Maureen Dowd uses it from time to time, New York Times, when a person believes that everything is rosy and everything is the best thing possible.
Deranged?
No. That's the word for it. I don't know what it is. But in any event, this concept actually is a concept which is very, very basic to certain Hasidic philosophies. But again, as I said, the question is where free will or free choice comes in according to that. Mm-hmm. Now, since the Rambam doesn't make free will, we'll stop here, but since the Rambam doesn't make free will one of the 13 principles, it's not one of the 13 principles that you have free will. So Chassid might say, no, maybe you have limited free will. What difference does it make? It's not a primary tenet of Judaism. Primary tenet of Judaism is to believe that you're responsible for your attitudes. That's what it is. You take the attitude that what you're doing is good, what you're doing is bad, are you looking to come close to Hashem, not come close to Hashem, it may well be that everything which occurs otherwise in your life is sometimes just dictated by Hashem.
So if that's true, then that gives someone liberty to do anything they want, right? If I say there's no free will,
right,
then I can go do whatever I want, because whatever I think I want, I really don't want, it's really Hashem making me do it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very bad, because then you'll get a bunch of rushes.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Right. They're very difficult to simple. So what a Chassid would tell you is that, yeah, but sometimes Hashem does let free will take over. You never know. Never know
if
you're making a decision or not. If you're making a decision, Hashem has made a decision at that time. So that's not to take any chances. That's what I'll tell you.
I see.
Okay, so the point of the Rambam, when it says, Manhig l'chol avruim, with Animam is Manhig l'chol avruim, what the Rambam means, the way the Rambam explains it himself, is that God conducts nature. In other words, God conducts the world in a way that it is an environment which is suitable for human habitation. Not that Hashem dictates the life of people, but he conducts the world in a way in which the world will provide, you know, sun, the light, water, and so on and so forth, that those things will be conducted properly. But not, not the way some people interpret it, that it means that Hashem has Hashgacha Pratit. Okay? Anyway, we'll stop here for today. We'll come back to the next one.